Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives.
Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Melanie Hoffman. Melanie is an amazing artist. Melanie, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you, Pamela. It's really wonderful to hear your voice and to speak with you again.
Well, Melanie, tell folks what kind of art you do.
I have a background in fine art textiles. I have experience both attending art school in Mexico and also in Oakland at the California College of the Arts. And then more recently, I've been focusing on photography. And then that has led me into other fields like video and digital art. And I do a lot of different things.
And you also created the Mind Talk logo.
I did.
All right. Melanie, let's start from your beginnings. Tell us where you were born and what life was like for you just growing up in your home.
Okay. I was born in Seattle, Washington. My grandfather was in the Army, so I was born at Fort Lawton Army Hospital in Seattle. My parents met in the Unitarian Church. They were fairly liberal, and we didn't spend a lot of time in Seattle. We actually moved to Iowa initially for about the first year, and then my parents settled in Pleasant Hill, California. So that would be, let's see, the first house they bought was in 1956.
Wow.
In Pleasant Hill, California.
And do you have siblings?
I do. I have two brothers. My youngest brother is Russell, and he just moved to the Big Island recently. And my middle brother, Wayne, lives here in the Bay Area. He's actually been really instrumental recently because we've had two dogs with some special needs. And currently the dog that we have just doesn't do very well when we leave her alone for long periods of time. So he's been really helpful spending time with her, which has been really great.
That's wonderful. And, you know, so many times dogs with special needs do not ever find a home. So good for you and lucky for the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, she's super sweet and super affectionate. She just gets really anxious if she's left alone very long. Like, I'll get home and she'll be leaping up into the air.
Well, yeah. She's happy to have you home. Yeah, it is.
Right.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
As you were
so in terms of, yeah, I was going to continue a little bit about my childhood, but if you wanted to ask me the question.
No, I was actually going to ask you to continue.
Okay. All right. So we lived in Pleasant Hill, a couple different neighborhoods until I was nine. And at that point, there was actually a fairly large transition. My father had built a house in Lafayette, which is not too far from Pleasant Hill. And my parents decided to send us to one of the alternative schools of the 60s. So all three of us went to this small school in Martinez that was based on the Summerhill philosophy, where students basically design their own curriculum and the teachers are there more as resources rather than having a structured curriculum. And we also were non-graded. So for 6 years, I was in an environment where I pretty much created my own classes, my own experiences, and I wasn't graded for any of them. So that was a very influential part of my life. My parents were pretty involved in the anti-war movement, and they also helped found the Peace and Freedom Party. So, like, I remember going away one time on vacation, and while we were gone, there was a whole group of people living on our house and creating, like, anti-war materials. And
how did the neighbors respond?
Oh, I don't remember anything about the neighbors responding. I mean, this is California, and it's always been, in my experience, fairly liberal, but we did live in a somewhat rural area of Lafayette. Like, the property that we were on was a little bit over an acre, and I actually don't remember being that close to my neighbors. It was more the relationships that I had with people at my school, the teachers and the parents and the other students.
Looking,
so I was more of a commuter child. I would commute to see my friends.
Looking back on that, the educational experience that you just described, would you recommend that for folks or no?
Well, I think there's some really good aspects to that type of an education because it creates a lot of independence. When I did actually go back to public school, it was a bit of a shock. I hadn't gotten just even the basics in terms of grammar and things like that. I mean, I did plenty of reading and plenty of writing, but I didn't ever get the formal structure. One thing that I can remember is right before I went to Pinell, I was learning my multiplication tables, and then that was never continued when I went to Pinell. So I ended up having to learn them as an adult, which is not typical. And also, it was hard to fit in. It was hard to follow along and accept authority and those kind of things. So I think a combination of having that kind of freedom and structure would be the most ideal, rather than the really strict, like, regimented education system that we have now.
Yeah. Would you say that there was a person or an event that really promoted your artistic self?
Not so much a specific person, but actually a number of people. The first one being my grandmother, my mother's mother, Zura, who was an artist. And she was like one of the early abstract artists. She really enjoyed working in an abstract way, which wasn't that typical for someone in her age group. And then in my school, we had a really wide art curriculum, if you could call that. We had parents and teachers who taught weaving, who taught macrame, who taught batik, there was one parent who was a professional seamstress, and we would get to go into her workplace and actually work with her on her professional machines and learn how to do tailoring and things like that. So it was an environment that really encouraged that kind of creativity.
How did you get from there to Mexico in 1975?
Okay, let's see. Well, I was living in Marin, and let me just backtrack for a second and say that I did go to Berkeley High, and I graduated a year early. And at that point, I thought, oh, I'm not going to go to college. And then about 6 months later, I thought, oh, my God, I need to go to college. So I was living in Marin and had roommates, and there was somebody next door who had gone to this place, the Instituto Allende in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and it just sounded really appealing. I mean, I wanted to study art. They had a textiles program. It seemed like it would be fun to live in a foreign country, and so I decided to go.
How old were you when you went?
I was 19.
And did you go by yourself or with other folks?
I went by myself.
That's a...
Which, in retrospect, was like, oh my God, what was I thinking?
Exactly. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was pretty bold. I mean, I got on an airplane and landed in Mexico City, and I actually had a medical issue when I arrived in Mexico City, and I had to have a doctor come to my hotel room and have an operation, like within the first couple of days that I was there.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, it was, I had developed this vaginal cyst, like, right before I left, and then it had gotten a lot worse, and I realized that I had to do something about it, but I didn't want to delay my trip, so I went ahead and went. So right when I got there, it was a fairly traumatic experience in a foreign country, in a hospital that I'd never been to, and nobody was there with me. And yeah, so the whole experience was pretty difficult from the very beginning, although it was an incredibly beautiful place and a very memorable place, and a place that I actually went back to later on. Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting the kinds of decisions that 19-year-olds can make.
It is. Yeah. Yes, I agree.
All right, so you're in Mexico, you're 19 years old, and you're studying art. What was your life like?
Well, let's see. At first, I had met this couple who had a couple of children. They just actually had a newborn, and I thought, well, I could move in with them, and so I did. And basically, what happened was the husband started making advances at me. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is not a safe place for me to be living.
Right.
And so I ended up finding my own place and living alone in Mexico on the edge of town. I actually shared a wall with a weaving factory. So I didn't even have another family on the other side of me.
So it was you and the weaving factory?
It was me and the weaving factory. Yeah. And as I recall, that particular street may not have even been paved. Yeah. It was fairly remote. I actually went back there, let's see, I think it was in 1996 with a friend and with my daughter Emily. And the entire property had been leveled. It was, I'm not sure if it burned down or what happened, but the place where I lived was no longer there.
1975 was an interesting year for you.
It was. There was just so much going on. There was the art school and my friends that I met there, and the studies that I was doing. I was studying weaving and Spanish and natural dyes, and it was very interesting. I met a lot of people from all over the world. It's the kind of place where people come to study art from Canada, United States, from Africa, from Europe. So it was an international type of experience. And then I've been there, I think, about 4 or 5 months, and I had started hearing about a serial rapist, of all things, in this tiny little colonial town way up in the mountains. And for some reason, he tended to target much older women, like women in their 60s or 70s who were living alone. And then one day I was, I feel a little anxious talking about this, but one day I was in my
take your time
home, in the place where I was living, and as I recall, I was in the bathroom, and I started to hear noises out in the main area of where I was living. And so I walked out, and there was a man standing there. He had a bandana tied around his face, and he had a gun, and it was pointed right at me.
Oh, no.
And I thought, oh, my God. And I was thinking, well, I don't think I was thinking very much at all, but I just had remembered, oh, my God, there's this serial rapist, and here he is pointing this gun at me. And I started screaming, thinking somebody has got to hear me and come and help me. And I could hear the sound of the looms on the other side of the wall. From my own experience of weaving, there's some noise involved. So I thought, yeah, somebody's got to come. Somebody has to help me. And he was screaming a word that I had never heard and that I didn't understand, that sounded like coyote, but it was like coyote or something like that. And later I discovered that basically he was telling me to shut up, to be quiet.
Okay. Did anyone ever come, Melanie?
No. Nobody ever came to help me. He grabbed me by the shoulders. I stopped screaming. I just thought, well, I mean, I know what's going to happen, and I'm just going to have to submit to it because he could shoot me. I mean, I don't think I even really thought. I just kind of knew that I needed to submit, that there wasn't really any way out of the situation. So he dragged me outside, and he dragged me so violently that it actually scraped the tops of my feet as he dragged me across the concrete. And then he raped me. So.
And
when, yeah.
When he left, did anyone come then?
No. Well, actually, I'm sorry. Somebody did come, but not right away. But I just wanted to say one more thing about it, and that was that in the process of the rape, he had put the gun down on the ground. And one thing that I do remember was that I was somehow able to get a hold of the gun and throw it over the fence. And the fence was actually how he had gotten over. He'd into the place where I was living. He'd probably thrown a blanket or something over the glass that was on top of the concrete wall and had scaled that. And then the back door to the place where I was living was not locked. The front door was locked. And that's how he gotten in. So anyway, that was the way he exited as well. And then in terms of someone coming over, there was a good friend that I had named Rhonda, who was one of the students at the art school, and she was from Canada. And she came over probably within about, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes after he left, not knowing, of course, what had happened. We actually walked, I think it was about 5 blocks to the police station to report it. And when we got to the police station, there was a counter and there were a lot of guys behind the counter. And as I recall, maybe they were playing cards or something. But anyway, they were just like having a good time, basically. So I went up the counter and I brought along this guy's belt that he had left behind, and I thought for sure, based on everything that I had heard living here in the Bay Area, that they would take a report and that they would investigate and that I would go to the doctor and that all those things would be taken care of. And instead of that, they just laughed at me.
Oh,
and they told me that if I saw him again, I should bring him in. And that was kind of the end of it. I sort of went into a state of shock and went home with my friend Rhonda, who was living with some friends. And then we ended up moving in together.
Melanie, we're going to take a break for a moment.
Okay.
When we come back, if it's okay with you, I'd like to pick up right here.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Melanie Hoffman, who is an artist who creates beautiful things in many mediums. We'll be right back. Melanie, the idea of you being a young girl by yourself in a foreign country, dragged from your home, assaulted, that you would have the presence of mind to actually throw the gun over the fence is extraordinary. And then I think about, thank goodness your friend came by, but here you had just been violently assaulted and you were actually walking to the police station. And they laughed at you when you tried to report.
Yeah. I mean, just sitting here, I can still feel the emotion of that.
It's stunning. You left with your girlfriend. You eventually moved in with her. Did you ever see him again?
I never saw him again, no. But with the advent of the internet, I did do some investigation to see if there had been other rapes after mine, and it turned out that there were a new series of rapes that took place around 2006, and I have no way of knowing if it was the same person or not, but I think it probably was, because I was in touch with a woman who was raped, and she is an author. She wrote the book about, I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's something about riding in cars with boys, and her first name is Beverly. And from what she described, it sounded like the same person.
Really?
Who would have been in his, like, 20s when it happened to me, and then I think in the 50s, when it happened to her. In her case, since she was well known and she was able to write about it in the local newspaper, she finally got the attention of the authorities and actually the FBI, and they caught him and they put him in jail. And as I said, who knows, maybe it's not the same person, but it was someone who had spent some time in jail in the United States, in Texas, and then had come back. So it kind of makes sense that it might be the same person.
Yeah. Did you, other than your friend who sort of miraculously showed up after the assault, did you talk to anyone else about what happened?
I don't remember talking to anybody. I just remember after the police station, I took a bath and I tried to pull myself together. But as it turned out, it wasn't very much later that I came down with hepatitis A, and I was so ill that I couldn't go to school or really function very well at all. And then I decided to come back to the Bay Area. I was terribly homesick, and you know, I just wanted to go home
and maybe be in a place that felt safe.
Right. I mean, you know, not that my family was safe either, but in comparison, it felt like a good place to come. So So I did return to the United States. And then, I feel like I'm doing therapy or something. okay. So
Melanie,
when I got back to the United States,
I'm just going to ask you to just take a moment just to catch your breath, because I know this is hard. And you're telling us about, this is not some story that you're reporting on. This is your life. These are your experiences. So I just want you to take a moment. And when you're able, I'd like for you, to the best of your ability, to explain to the listener what hepatitis A is. I would think there are many people who don't really know. So when you're ready, tell us about hepatitis A.
Okay. All right. So hepatitis A is actually a foodborne, generally, condition, and it's fairly easily passed by eating contaminated food. And generally speaking, it's fairly short-lived. And as I recall, I had hepatitis C for about 3 weeks. And during that time, I was very sick. I was, vomiting, diarrhea, passing out, very fatigued, aches and pains. I was very, very sick. But it didn't last very long. And then during that period of time, when I was still sick, I decided I need to leave. I need to go back. And the paperwork that I had received, the visa or whatever it was that I had received when I had arrived, had expired. And so I needed to go to Mexico City and get my papers renewed. And I just remember that kind of extreme fight or flight kind of feeling.
Sure.
Like sort of a panic. Like how am I going to do all this? How am I going to get my papers and get on the airplane and go back home? But I was somehow able to do all of that.
Did you do it alone?
And then I did it all alone. Yeah, I did. And thinking about it now, I'm thinking, gosh, I mean, I sent a telegram to my dad and told him what happened. I mean, how come they didn't come? But I still don't know.
Take your time. You told your family what happened. You told your dad, and he didn't come to be with you to try to comfort you during this time.
And now nobody came.
And when you got your papers, when you got your papers and you came back to the States, alone still?
I moved in with my father, actually, and my stepmother.
How was that?
It was challenging. Well, it was challenging because of what had happened, but it was also challenging because when they arranged for me to see a doctor, the doctor diagnosed me with type 1 diabetes. And so I had another crisis on my hands. I mean, just sitting here right now, I think, oh my God, how did I survive?
Well, it's a good question.
But I did.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
What is type 1 diabetes?
Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that where the pancreas basically stops producing insulin. So the only way that you can survive is to take insulin.
And by this time, you were how old?
I was still 19 when I returned. I had gone to Mexico in January of 1975, and I had returned, I think, in May of 1975. And then in June, I had my 20th birthday.
There was so much that happened, and you went off to Mexico with such promise in your spirit. How did all these things impact you, your creativity, if they did, as you returned back to the States?
It had a big impact. I lost my confidence in being an artist as a profession, and I ended up changing my major and completing a degree at San Francisco State in Recreation and Leisure Studies, which was related in the sense that I could still teach art and do art projects with children and things like that, but it wasn't the dream that I had of being a fine artist.
The people around you, as you changed your major, as you changed your life, were they aware of what was generating some of these changes for you? Was there someone you could talk to, confide in, who could hold your hand emotionally as well as physically?
Not at that time, no. No. I really basically spent my 20s being pretty self-destructive and thinking somehow that, oh, there was just something terribly wrong with me and I was just never really going to have the life that I had thought that I was going to have. And so I just basically gave up on it and didn't really try to do very much. I also had a bad experience with a therapist when I was 17. So I didn't really think of that as an option.
What happened?
He asked me to take off part of my clothing.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a man who works for Marin County Mental Health. Yeah.
Did you tell anyone?
I did tell my boyfriend at the time, who also was in the mental health field and working at Marin General Hospital, and he didn't do anything about it.
And your parents, anyone else?
I don't remember telling my parents about it. I do remember telling a good friend about it, and she was also seeing this person for therapy and told me that something similar had happened to her.
Oh, my. So what I'm hearing is certainly for a large chunk of time during your really formative years, you experience loss, betrayal, aloneness, just really being, I mean, almost completely alone emotionally in the world as you were going through all these horrific experiences. The betrayal of the therapist, how did that affect you?
Well, primarily it affected me by not believing that therapy would be a good option for me in terms of helping me. But I'd also been molested by my grandfather and had experienced being violated as a teenager. So it kind of felt sort of par for the course at that point in my life. And of course now it just seems absurd. how could anything like that happen to anybody? And I mean, this is crazy, but I didn't know that at the time. It was like my reality, my experience of life, so I didn't really know anything different. And then when I was 30, I had been smoking cigarettes, actually, as one way of coping for about 5 years. And I stopped smoking, and all of a sudden, I would go to work, and I would look at myself in the mirror, and I'd just start to cry. And I'd think, oh, my God, what's going on? And I ended up moving in with my mother, who was living in Seattle at the time, and starting therapy. And that was about 30 years ago at this point. And that was like the beginning. When I turned 30, it was the beginning of the healing process.
So that therapist was a better fit for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, actually, I saw several people, I think, at the same time. I saw a psychiatrist who was very kind of alternative in his approach. He was not the psychiatrist who used medication, for example. And then I had also developed some eating problems, and I went to a group for compulsive eaters. And then I was also, as I recall, seeing an individual therapist. So I just jumped right in, and it was hard. It was really hard. But as I recall, I spent about a year in Seattle until I felt like I was able to go back to work. And then I returned to the Bay Area and started working.
The resilience that it certainly took then for you to go through all of those experiences and really come out on the other end as a survivor, you had to have thought, nothing else. I'm not going to get another diagnosis. I'm not going to have another illness. This has got to be it.
That's true. I just thought, boy, I've been through it. I'm not going to be dealing with anything else. But as it turned out, a new doctor that I was seeing at Kaiser in 2002 listened to what I had to say about my medical history and about the hepatitis A. And he said, I think we should do a test for hepatitis and see for sure what kind of hepatitis you had. And he ran the test, and unbeknownst to me, he also checked me for hepatitis C, which was not even on my radar. I never even thought about hepatitis C. And it turned out I was positive.
And what is hepatitis C as distinguished from A?
Well, hepatitis C is generally transmitted through blood. And in approximately 25% of cases, people actually clear it with no treatment. It just, the body's immune system deals with it and it goes away on its own. But in at least 75% of the case, it becomes chronic. And so the liver it becomes inflamed, and the viral load can, the viral load, I guess, doesn't really mean that much, but the body keeps replicating the virus. And so you're in a constant state of fighting off a virus, basically.
Which is exhausting emotionally as well as physically and medically and everything else. Melanie, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to start with where you are today in your life and with your family as you were dealing with hepatitis C. We'll be right back.
Okay.
The point that you were diagnosed with hepatitis C, were you alone? Were you in a relationship? What was going on?
I met my wife, Jane, in 1998. So we had been together for about 4 years at that point. And at that point, also, marriage was not yet legal in California, so we were not married. But we've actually been together now for almost 18 years. And then, of course, my daughter Emily was also with us.
So you were not alone this time, but hepatitis C is a big diagnosis.
It is, and I didn't even really realize the implications at the time. The impression that I got from the specialist that I saw was that it was something that I had, but it wasn't really something that I could do anything about, because the treatments that were available at the time only had about a 50% success rate, and they also had complications that would be problematic for me, the main one being depression, which I had already struggled with a great deal. So it didn't seem like it would be a good idea to do the treatment, and my doctors pretty much agreed with me about that.
So what did that mean for you in terms of the Hep C? What did you do?
Well, I just put it on the back burner and hope for the best, and continue to eat a healthy diet, get regular exercise, do the best I could with keeping my stress level down, which has been challenging. But I didn't really see any option other than to live with it.
And do people live with it?
People do, but something I learned a couple of years ago when I finally got a test for fibrosis is that having the hepatitis C virus for a long time generally results in liver scarring. And in my case, I had developed stage 3 fibrosis without even knowing it. Even doing everything I could to take care of myself and not drinking and not using drugs and not doing all the things that could exacerbate it. And actually, the impression that I was given by most of the doctors that I had seen up until that point was that really only, say, 10% of people with hepatitis C develop really serious problems. But what they were talking about was really serious problems, like liver cancer and some of the other complications, which are really life-threatening. But they didn't talk so much about what that meant for general health and how it could affect your mind and all the other things.
Well, what did it mean for you and your daughter and your wife, this diagnosis that a lot of people have never heard of, and those who have may not know a whole bunch about it, but you were living it. How did it affect the three of you?
Well, initially it was just really scary. It's like, oh my goodness, not only do I have type 1 diabetes, which is a serious condition, but now I know, because I probably had it for at least 30 years, that I have hepatitis C. What am I going to do? Is it going to mean that I'm not going to live very long, or that my health is going to become very poor? Or I just didn't know. It was just scary. And I remember Jane in particular just being really frightened to the point where she was seeking support to deal with the diagnosis as well. And then over the years, as my daughter has gotten older, she has been very concerned about me and wanting to make sure that I was going to stick around for her. In fact, the other day she was saying, if you die, I'm going to kill you. It was kind of a joke.
You say, gee, thanks.
Please don't die, Mom. Anyway, when the opportunity finally came and the new drugs came out that are more effective and that don't have those side effects, I was really lucky to receive treatment and be cured. It was like a miracle.
Be cured.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, these medications were pretty pricey.
They are very pricey. And in my case, I actually did it before the FDA approved a medication called Harvoni that was released in October of 2014, and I did my treatment in April of 2014. So I actually took two drugs made by two different companies that weren't approved for use with each other by the FDA, but it had been studied and proven to be highly effective. And the cost of the two drugs together was $150,000 for 12 weeks.
$150,000 for 12 weeks?
Can you imagine?
Who on earth could afford that? I mean, it is absurd. I mean, it's hard to wrap your brain around that.
Yes, it's very difficult. And I just thought, oh my God, how is it ever going to be possible that I'm going to get this treatment? But at that point, what happened was my doctor at the time requested these drugs from my insurance company, and I got a denial saying, you have to have at least stage 3 fibrosis to have us pay for this treatment. And then I did the test for fibrosis, and I had stage 3. So they paid for it. But if I hadn't, they wouldn't have.
But
so there are quite a few people now who are, because of these regulations by the insurance companies, for obvious reasons. I mean, this could cost insurance companies thousands and thousands of millions and trillions of dollars to treat everybody, which is crazy. So, I mean, the whole way that the system is set up is ridiculous, because we have the capacity right now to cure almost everybody with hepatitis C, and yet it's being limited because of the cost.
$150,000 for 3 months.
Yeah. The cost has actually come down with the advent of Harvoni. I think currently the full cost of that is about $92,000.
I feel so much better.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much better. But
let's just go write a check.
Yeah. And then it's interesting, because sometimes people say, oh, well, you have to be rich to be treated for hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. And that's not really true. What you really need to be treated for hepatitis C is good insurance.
Right. And, I mean, F3, you were stage 3. So that meant that scarring had spread further and the areas of scarring had started to connect?
Right. Yeah, it's called, I think, bridging fibrosis. I don't know all the technical terms, but the next stage after stage 3 is stage 4, which is cirrhosis. And once you reach that stage, it's very difficult for the liver to recover.
So literally you have to be at death's door in order for the insurance company to cover it, at least these medications for this condition.
It depends. There are certainly some insurance companies that have different policies.
Okay.
But, and I was not at death's door, per se. I mean, my liver was certainly indicating that there was a serious problem, but I didn't feel seriously ill. I just had issues with fatigue and depression and aches and pains and things like that. But it wasn't like I was bedridden or not able to function.
Well, but again, I mean, it sounds like you were one step away from, from a measure of illness that certainly would have complicated your life significantly. Were you able to work as you were taking this medication during this? So you were on the 12-week protocol?
Right. I was on the 12-week protocol of the two medications called Sovaldi, which is made by Gilead, and Olysio, which is made by Janssen. And during that time, Jane and I and our dog Petey went on a vacation for 4 weeks. We went on a road trip to the Grand Tetons, Yellowstone, different places, and actually been able to create a new clothing line, for example, using some of the images that I shot in Yellowstone.
A new clothing line? That's exciting.
Yeah, it's. I'm really excited about that. It's an online venue called Shop Vida, and so those images that I took of the geothermal geyser activity in Yellowstone are on various apparel designs.
That is fab, and that's Shop Vida. Spell that for us.
It's V-I-D-A.
Okay.
Now, yeah, and just off the top of my head, I don't know the entire URL, but if you go to Google and put in Shop Vida, and then when you get there, you can put in my name, and it's easy to look at my collection.
Okay. At some point, the 12-week protocol was ended, and you were pronounced cured?
Yes, actually, it's 12-week post-treatment that you're actually declared cured.
Okay.
So it was in October of 2014 that I was given the news that I was pronounced cured. But actually, after just 4 weeks of taking the medication, my viral load had gone down from over 7 million to nothing.
To nothing, wow. So this medication was powerful and clearly worked.
They're very powerful. And not only that, the liver enzymes, the ALT and the AST that had been elevated for at least 30 years were normal.
Oh, my. Oh, my. That's really extraordinary.
Yeah. It was a huge change.
When you received the word that you had been deemed cured, what was that like for you and your wife?
Just a tremendous relief. It was just kind of unbelievable. I think we actually still need to celebrate that. So sometimes it's easy to overlook the need to celebrate things.
That's very true. And if you have not celebrated it, by all means, you could start today.
Right. Yeah. I did have a really wonderful 60th birthday party in June where about 60 people showed up.
Oh, that's wonderful.
One of the things that I enjoy in addition to art is doing various kinds of energy healing techniques. And so I was offering free energy healing sessions with a number of my friends who are healers and do sound and different kinds of shamanic practices and things like that. So in a way, that was a celebration. And then we also renewed our wedding vows because the first time we got married, it was in the context of a small office party for Jane's work. yeah.
So you, by yourself, have been through a huge amount. You and your wife and your daughter have certainly been through more than your shared fair share of trauma. For those listening to you right now who are perhaps dealing with a chronic illness or a significant diagnosis, what would you say to them?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one of the things for me to remember for myself is that it doesn't really mean anything about me as a person in terms of being less than. There's a lot of information out there, especially in the New Age community, that says that if your vibration is high enough and you're thinking all the right thoughts and all of that, that you won't have any illness. But I don't think that's what it's about, really. I think it's more about the strength and the character that you have and the qualities that you're able to develop through adversity. And hopefully you're using those in a positive way to connect more with other people, to express your creativity, to open your heart. I really think it's more about loving yourself than anything.
Melanie Hoffman, thank you so much for sharing your story, your trials, your successes, your resiliences. Congratulations again on that clothing line. Actually, spell your name for us, if you would. I would think that some folks might want to look you up on the web.
Okay. Yeah, there are quite a few sites that feature my work. My first name, Melanie, is M-E-L-A-N-I-E. And my last name, Hoffman, has a little bit of an unusual spelling. It's H-O-F-M-A-N-N.
Okay, one F, two N's. Don't misspell
it. Yes. That's the most common thing that happens in the world is that people misspell my last name.
Again, Melanie, thank you. Thank you to your family, and thank you to you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, and for, quite frankly, being an inspiration for many people who are listening right now. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you.
Alrighty. And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand every day, any day, at myndtalk.org. All of the programs are available on demand. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to Pamela, that's P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember, too, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.